This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Okay, so question and answer session. We have about 45 minutes, so I will start with the first set of speakers in the first 20 minutes or so, and then I will turn it over to Tina. So picking it up where Tina left it in her summary, first I have a question for David, and that is about kind of the implications of your research that has pointed towards the voice box again and again. So what do you make out of that? Would you say that Neanderthals couldn't speak, or they had less of a language, or, I mean, language certainly being one of the traits that makes humans humans and is so special about us? Do we have more complex language than they had? I mean, there's also this research done by various people on FoxB2, kind of including myself. I worked on that in the past. And the kind of admixture work has actually shown that the FoxB2 region, which is a gene that is important for language, doesn't tolerate Neanderthal admixture. It's a desert. The entire region around this language gene does not tolerate Neanderthal or Denisovan admixture. So both admixtures, it's actually not present there. So is language the key to what makes us human? So what's your interpretation to that?
So unfortunately, I don't feel like we have the data to conclude like the on differences in language and even speech between Neanderthals and modern humans. We see this very strong signal that keeps coming up that something anatomical in a vocal tract probably changed in its regulation between modern humans and Neanderthals. We see it only in modern humans. So when we run the same analyses in archaic humans, we never see this signal. It's always modern human specific. What does it do? I don't know. We know that these are genes that control the anatomy of the vocal tract, but they also do other stuff. They control the face, the projection of the face, bone density, skeletal maturation rate. So they do have these what is called pleiotropic effect. So we're not even sure that the signal we see is driven by vocal tract function. But the fact that it's the most enriched signal does point in that direction. Now, even if the signal if these changes affected our vocal tract anatomy, there's still this huge thing called the brain. So most of our linguistic abilities are encoded in the brain, controlled by the brain. And we don't know how this interaction between our anatomy and brain function actually works. So unfortunately, I feel like we have some hints there, but I would not go beyond that to say whether we can say anything about Neanderthal and modern human differences in this regard.
Okay. Thank you, David. Then I have a question here for Janet. So I guess for Neanderthals, we've seen there's some pathogenic variants like the one on chromosome 3 where there's this variant that gives a 3 times higher kind of chance to die of COVID. Are there also examples from Denisovans, like pathogenic variants that came through to admixture in modern human populations today that are not giving us an advantage, but actually a disadvantage? And why would it be different between Neanderthals and Denisovans if that's not the case?
So it's an interesting question. And of course, Neanderthal ancestry is much better studied, or the effects of Neanderthal ancestry in present-day people is much better studied than the effects of Denisovan ancestry. And that's simply because European populations are studied more widely than the populations who carry Denisovan ancestry, like the people of Papua. So we have a less good handle on what the effects of Denisovan ancestry are. There have been some studies. They're largely focused not... they're not using biobank type data that allow you to look directly at the phenotype. They're inferring the effect of a variant from the gene that it's in. And so we do know that Denisovan alleles do have phenotypic effects in individuals. The EPAS gene came up a number of times. This is an adaptive variant. The most striking signal, the largest contribution from Denisovan related alleles in present day populations is to immunity. And here I think we don't have actually examples of genes that have a negative effect or variants that have a negative effect. But perhaps that's because in large part, what I think is probably quite likely is that we see contributions to immune genes from both Neanderthals and Denisovans. And the variants that they contribute can have both positive and or negative effects depending on the environment, depending on the pathogens that are present. And so we see this sort of yin-yang you can have a positive or a negative effect depending on whether or not a specific pathogen is present, for example. So no specific examples, but I think it's probably very likely that there are Denisovan alleles that have negative effects as there are Denisovan alleles that have positive effects.
Thank you. And then for Diendo, the question, you know, is multiple questions, in fact, about African ancient DNA. And what's the chance to find some of the ghost lineages that have been described in Africa that might have admixed into modern humans? And will we find them? Will there be archaic humans from Africa? So what do you think is the chance in the future that we can study things like we have in Eurasia, also in Africa?
So I will just like say exactly like the comment of Tina at the end is like things go so fast and like it's very difficult to predict what will happen next. And it just looked like, yeah, we're making all those like discovery every day. And I'm very optimistic, actually. And also like what I believe is also like those ghost African population or archaic population in Africa probably are not even like as old, or they did not went extinct. Like I'm pretty sure that like in maybe only 5,000 years or 10,000 years ago, they were still around actually in Africa, which I think like the day we are going to actually find the fossils, maybe like we will have more chance actually to find the DNA, because probably not, they are not so old. So I'm like just very, very, very optimistic about like, pretty sure like in the next 10 years, we'll have like much more data about like those populations, yeah.
Okay, thanks. I have a question for Tina. There's a microphone with Einar. So there's a question about probiotics for the oral microbiome, because you showed that there's this big loss in diversity in the oral microbiome. So should we do probiotics and kind of enrich our oral microbiome again? And there was also another question, is why do you think it disappeared 200 years ago? So what changed in the last 200 years that made all the oral microbiome to disappear?
It's a great question. One of the things that's important to know about dental biofilms is that they grow like forests. So you have the initial colonizers that are largely belong to just two genera, so Actinomyces and Streptococcus. They both have the ability, they have the ability to bind on to the acquired enamel pellicle. They bind on, they form the first layer, and then other bacterial species actually have receptors that specifically bind on to them, so it's a highly co-evolved system, and then others bind on to them, and they build these highly structured, actually quite beautiful systems. If you ever have a chance to look at your dental plaque under a microscope, it's gorgeous. But it really does grow like a forest, like the trees in the forest undergo succession, and you have new waves of different trees that take root as the niches change. What it looks like when you look at those species that are being lost, the properties they have, they all share a common property, and that they are all late colonizers, or nearly all late colonizers. So we don't lose the early colonizers, we don't lose the aerotolerant species. We're primarily losing the end stage, the hemlocks, as you were, of a deciduous forest are what are being lost. And they're the ones that are the end stage biofilm colonizers that occupy the most nutrient depleted niches for the oldest biofilms. They're strict anaerobes, and they have all sorts of features related to that. And we think that's a toothbrushing effect, because what toothbrushing effectively does is every day you're removing that plaque and you're starting anew. So you're constantly growing these young forests, and you're not allowing the old forest to grow. The question then becomes, after how many generations do you permanently lose those older members? There's been some work done in the gut microbiome, for example, in mouse models that show over a series of generations, you eventually do permanently lose those species. And so we may be in that right now. One thing that's very interesting, though, is that I focused on the industrialized plaque in the comparison, but if we look at hunter-gatherer plaque, for which there's not a lot of data, but we are trying to get more. In fact, we published the first dental plaque study of hunter-gatherers only a couple of years ago. They actually retain most of those species that we see in ancient populations. So this does seem to be something quite specific to industrialization, and we think to oral hygiene and the prevention of the full development of the biofilm. Now, what's really interesting, though, is those late colonizers today, if you do have them today, they're often associated with periodontal disease, so they're considered largely pathogenic. However, in the past, we don't see that association. So one of the questions our research is raising is, what is their true ecological function in the biofilm? Today, we really only see them in this highly disturbed, highly altered state. But in a fully mature biofilm that's allowed to develop to its full capacity, what roles do they actually play? And we don't know.
So probiotics or not?
So, will there be a cryptococcus, ophthonus, a toothpaste you can put on? I don't know. I think we have a lot of work to do to understand the functions. I mean, one thing that really stuck out to me when we first did our initial study in, a few years ago in 2021 is that we have a whole series of genera that are part of our core oral microbiome. They have co-evolved with us for over 40 million years. We have 10 genera that have co-evolved over that time and many species within them. And for fully half of them, we know nothing about what they do. So I think one of the problems we have in periodontal disease is it's been so focused on this infectious disease model of finding the bad pathogen and killing it. But what we actually know is that oral health and microbial health is more about community balance. And since we don't know what half the community actually does, it's very hard to, I think, solve the problem of periodontal disease. So I think we need to have a kind of mind shift change in oral microbiology to also study not only what causes disease, but what causes health. Because this balance is essential for maintaining health. And when we only understand what half of them do, we're missing a big part of that puzzle.
Thank you. Question for Chung Wan. So there's this diffusion of culture and technology that in many cases was from Western Eurasia into Eastern Eurasia. Does that explain the predominance of West Eurasian Y chromosomes in Central and, I guess, parts of Eastern Asia at least, and East Asian mitochondrial DNA in regions like Kazakhstan and Mongolia? So was there probably also sex-biased movement of people, migration there, or, yeah, but don't understand every detail of the question, but maybe you do.
Yeah. So I think it's important. I stopped at the beginning of the Christianity period, but the important feature of the step genetic history is that it keeps rewriting itself by introducing new rounds, new big waves of human migrations and admixture. So you can see definitely like multiple different historical admixtures overlaying and erasing with each other. So I think the modern day like Central Asians Y chromosomal and mitochondrial profiles are actually a very recent combination. So it's only from the last few hundred years, and there might have happened this, you know, like sex bias gene flow. And we have seen different cases of sex bias gene flows or lack of it across different major admixture events in different times and space. So it's not always like male from the West dominates, something like that. So I think it's hard to generalize. And overall, if you look into the direction of migration, then during the Bronze Age, it's mostly from the West to the East. Yeah, because like all these animals started in the West and had to spread to the East. So it was like from the beginning, they have this like early starter effect. And then if you see the Iron Age, then you are actually seeing the admixture clines are going across the steppe, and then now you are seeing then some of the eastern components are showing up in the West, like the Scytho-Siberian groups. And then from the Xingnu and onward, that the major admixture flows start to go in the other way around, because most of the key nomadic empires or the steppe empires started from the Mongolian steppe and expanded into the West. So yeah, it's variable, as very dynamic as the history of the steppe itself is, and then, hard to generalize.
Okay, then one question maybe for Janet and David, which is a bit related to the phenotype. So the different admixture that we see in different Eurasian populations, have they contributed to the phenotypic differences that we see between those populations? So if you think about Oceanians having more the Denisovan DNA, then non-Africans having all Neanderthal DNA, Africans, sub-Saharan Africans not having any of those archaic human admixture. So Is that because of the admixture? And what is basically the legacy of the admixture in the phenotypic features that we see between those groups? A bit contentious, I understand, but.
I'll keep it simple. So I think for me is the most striking result of the introgression study is what we see that remains from introgression from both Neanderthals and Denisovans in people living today is not that it has massive phenotypic effects in the sense of how someone looks or acts, but that the variants that our ancestors got from Neanderthals or Denisovans have been instrumental in local adaptation. So what we see are variants that are involved in immunity, so allowing us to adapt to pathogens in different parts of the world, metabolism, so adapting to new diet in different parts of the world, in Eurasia as entering, and then what I would call environmental adaptations, adaptations to new UV radiation regimes, so higher latitudes, adaptation to higher altitudes, and things like that. So it's an interesting pattern. It's sort of this sort of adaptive introgression pattern where what we mixed with the Neanderthals, our ancestors, some of our ancestors mixed with Neanderthals, some other ancestors mixed with Denisovans. What was the major pattern of selection on that ancestry was a negative selection against a lot of the ancestry very early on in the first few 10 to 20 generations. What remains is then a representation of adaptive alleles to the environments in which our ancestors then found themselves.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe ask David a different question because I think it was a great answer already. And you can also answer to it if you want to. But that was a different question, maybe short question. We have a lot of people interested in brain evolution here. What's the evolutionary advantage of the cerebellum? So why is there this big difference? You see also the selection signal in the cerebellum. And why would there be this big difference between archaics and modern humans? Because I guess cerebellum is a bit more kind of basic in some ways than the...
Yeah, so cortex. Our understanding of the cerebellum keeps evolving. I'm not a neuroscientist, but from what I know, in the past it was more connected to motor function and things like that. Today it is clear that it is also involved in language, rhythm, more complex motor behavior control. The differences that we see are very high level. So genes that affect the size of the cerebellum, genes that affect connectivity, but not sub functions that we can point to. So, and also when we talk about the fossil record, what is reported is differences in the morphology, size, shape of the cerebellum, but we're not sure how this affects its function. So again, it's still unclear and very vague.
Okay. Thank you. We have many more questions, but we also should pass it on to the next set of people because it's already half the time over. So, Tina, please.
Thanks, Johannes. All right. The first question is actually, it's for Manasa. And this is talking about technological constraints on DNA preservation. And so the question is, how ancient can ancient DNA get? And how does that vary in different parts of the world?
Well, I feel like I'm answering on behalf of this whole team now. I mean, this number has been constantly pushed back for obvious reasons. Technology gets better. Also, as Deando showed us, our awareness of how to sample smartly and strategically also gets better as we understand perhaps which part of the anatomy preserves better. Also, other sources, for example. So some of the oldest material, unsurprisingly, comes from freezers of the world, which is Siberia or the Arctic. And here we as a field have managed to push back to beyond sort of the 1 million year range. And these, again, you know, they come from very pristine preservation environments, permafrost, which sort of kills microbial activity. There's sort of inert biochemical reactions there for a long, long time. Contrasting that with, you know, in my personal experience, working with even a few hundred-year-old or a few thousand-year-old individuals in the tropics may completely fail or may require a lot more effort in terms of preparing the DNA, but also the sequencing costs when it comes to the tropics, because you'll have very little DNA and you'll have a lot more of the environmental contamination. So again, a lot of labs in the field are working towards how to keep making this more efficient. There's methods like what Diendo suggested. There's also for human DNA itself, there's ways to enrich for human component over the environmental DNA. There's pros and cons of doing that and kind of also the budgetary constraints of each lab. It's sort of a generalized answer to the fact that we've managed to push back, in fact, beyond what we thought was possible. I think that's good to acknowledge here. There are theoretical limits to the decay life of DNA, but of course these don't take into account the extremes of the scenario, one being the very, very cold preservation environments that obviously carry the DNA with them, or the really, really poor environments in the tropical belt.
Thank you. Our next question is for Einash. And it's about lactase persistence and lactose tolerance. And if you could talk a little bit more about how those are related, and also whether a person's lactose tolerance can change over their lifetime, and what's the basis of that?
I think that's a really interesting question. So lactase persistence is a very well understood example of adaptation in humans. We know that in at least Western European populations, and especially Northern Europe, there are very high frequency of individuals who are lactase persistent. And by that, we mean that they produce the enzyme called lactase into adulthood, because this is not what we see in the majority of human populations, where it is only produced during childhood when a child is subsistent off of the milk, the breast milk. And once that period is over, the lactase production goes down. And in the majority of populations, we don't see lactase persistence. However, the whole phenotype of being able to digest lactose is obviously not only genetic. There are many other factors that play a role. So in this case, we think of the microbiome, so the bacteria that live in the gut that can help with the digestion of lactose. And those are, the various bacteria that are promoted in probiotics. For instance, these are lactobacteria that can be very helpful in digesting lactose. And this is something that we see in a lot of Central Asian populations that are generally non-persistent, so they don't carry the variants that are associated with the ability to digest lactose into adulthood, but they're still able to digest lactose with a variety of other factors, such as cultural adaptation, where you ferment the milk, you don't drink it raw anymore. So the amount of lactose goes down. The amount of lactose is also pretty low in products like hard cheeses that a lot of people who are lactose intolerant or lactase non-persistent can still consume. And the other aspect is, of course, the ability to digest via, the continuous consumption of milk and milk products, and the ability to sustain that microbiome. So one of the theories is that once you stop consuming milk, then the microbiota that is involved in the digesting of the lactose can die out, and then it would have to be reintroduced. So I think it is it's a fascinating example of human adaptation that is not only genetic, but also is environmental, and the microbiome is involved. So it's, as with many adaptations, it's a variation and a combination of many factors.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Our next question is for Johannes, and it's about how we interpret the archaeological record and the new data that we have, and kind of reflecting back on the information we've gained to turn over prior narratives. How do we keep new just so narratives from emerging? How do we responsibly interpret the findings that we make?
Yeah, I mean, what I learned over the years in archaeogenetics is that there is, this big body of literature in archaeology, which makes sense. It's a much older field. It's there for more than 100 years. And there's almost every story possible somewhere in archaeology, right? But all the topics I talked about, there is competing hypotheses about, say, farming. Did farming come with people, or was it rather culture that was spreading? Same with steppe populations. Was there actually a movement of people? Was it just culture spreading? It's often this question that we have pots or people. So when we have cultural changes that also connected to genetic change, so people moving, or is it just culture that is spreading? So in a way, when we have this archaeogenetic studies where we look at time transect, where we look at material from the past, we find patterns, we can often link it to some existing body of literature and archaeology, and we are often able to reject hypotheses that people have made, and sometimes we can support some of the hypotheses that people have made. What I think is sometimes a bit more hard is if there is not a body of literature there, we find something and then we have to come up with, you know, where's that signal coming from? And that's of course where it gets exciting, or where it really, there's just one type of hypothesis out there, we can reject it, but you know, we don't really have good explanations. This is where we can really contribute to a new understanding. So I think in many cases it's hypothesis testing, but I think there are also examples, and we've seen many of them presented today, about the Pacific, for example, the patterns we see there, and even about the steppe migrations, there were hypotheses there before that people came with kind of this kind of movement from the steppe, but to the extent no one had expected it. Or that, for example, Anglo-Saxons, they came to Great Britain, and it's clear they speak a Germanic language now and not a Celtic language or a Latin language, but then that it was an 80% replacement, no archaeologist had actually expected there was this big replacement of the British population about 1,500, 1,600 years ago. So I do think we can also basically add to new aspects of that and, of course, get a much better kind of quantitative way of looking into that. But what I also learned is that we need this interaction between archaeologists and geneticists. And it's not enough. I mean, the early days in archaeogenetics, people found a signal, they looked into Wikipedia and it's like, oh, that's it, right? So like one of our colleagues, and you know, I think he did a great, fantastic work on kind of looking into IBD, so identity by descent, like tracks that kind of people share, looked at Europeans and showed all Europeans are related to all Europeans in 1,000 years, which is great result and makes a lot of sense because over 1,000 years you have billions of ancestors, at least theoretically, so that they're all connected makes kind of sense. But then they found a signal and then they were like, oh, there was a signal 1,500 years ago, so what happened there? Oh, the Huns, it must be in the Huns. And then kind of in the kind of discussion was, oh, and the Huns were coming, kind of. So this is not how we should do it. I think we should really do it together and kind of look at all kind of aspects. And there's a whole body of literature that we have to get used to. And I think we've done a good job if we kind of look at the different topics we had today in anthropology. I was also working with Svante on the Neanderthal genomes. We had a lot of pushback when we started to study the genomes of Neanderthals because the anthropologists said, oh, you're destroying the kind of fossils, you're drilling holes, you make Swiss cheese out of them. I mean, Swiss cheese is great, but it's not nice. Basically, you destroy national heritage and you get nothing out of it, or we learn nothing. And I think we've seen today how much we learned about human origins from studying those ancient archaic human genomes. And then we started with archaeogenetics, but 5-6 years later, so about 2012, 13, 14, we started with archaeogenetics, because before, it's actually something, nobody talked about that, but why can we do archaeogenetics? Because we have learned in the Neanderthal Genome Project how to distinguish ancient DNA and modern DNA. Actually, no one has shown that today, but it's really something that a lot of people are not aware of that, but we have that problem that if you take a bone in your hand, you leave more DNA on that bone than is in that bone, right? And like all those samples have been kind of handled by, you know, a lot of people. So we had to come up with ways first to actually show that the DNA is from the past, because for Neanderthals, it's easy. They fall outside genetic variation. But for modern humans, right, if they're ancestors of the people here in the room, then why could it not be people from the room? Why has it to be someone from the past? And we actually looked at this DNA damage patterns that then we could actually use to say this is ancient DNA. From there on, the field actually emerged, which again was just about a decade ago. But then we basically had to also get into this close contact with archaeologists, which I think managed, and I think was a process. And I remember the first conferences, the archaeology conference I went to, and people were attacking me for kind of old narratives that were kind of, you know, kind of talked about 100 years ago, especially in Germany. there was really a lot of pushback, but I think we managed quite well. And I think, again, there was a lot of engagement over the last 10 years. And recently, we're kind of going through the same process. The third time I'm going through the same process, so first with the paleoanthropologists, then with the archaeologists. Now I'm doing that with the historians, which is the hardest nut to crack, I have to say. it's really because they're used to fighting among themselves a lot about the evidence and the kind of different texts and so forth. And now comes this kind of biochemist that tells history, right? I mean, that must be wrong, right? And so we get it. Attacked a lot, but I think there again, you engage with those people, you kind of exchange ideas. It's a new evidence, new kind of library that we're basically opening up here with DNA. And it's an exciting time, and I think we will manage that as well. We can contribute to historical time. So, long answer to short question, sorry.
Thank you. Our next question is for Andres, and it's about the early colonial period in Mexico and how in the late 16th century, the Spanish established a trade route between Acapulco and West Mexico and Manila in the Philippines, which was two centuries before Cook's Pacific voyages. And they're wondering, how big of a demographic impact or a genetic impact did that early trade route have?
Well, I would say on average, and then at a nationwide scale, as a picture we can get from collections like the Nationwide Biobank, I would say pretty limited. So actually the amount of that Asian ancestry that we found is not more than, you know, maybe 5-10%, which is, you know, not that low, but it's not like as prevalent as, for example, the indigenous or European, of course, because, you know, it was much more pervasive, the admixture levels there. But I think what we can do to amplify that signal is precisely that focus only on that fraction of the ancestry to see, you know, where it's concentrating. And that's how we found out this signal that is specifically in two locations. So today, I think I mostly focus on the one in the Guerrero coast in Acapulco, because that was the point of disembarkation of this Manila galleon. But then the biobank also gave a second signal in the Baja Peninsula. And turns out that the boat actually made a stop when weather was bad and they couldn't continue all the way to Acapulco. They actually stopped in the La Paz Bay, which is on the inner part of the Baja Peninsula, until you know, weather was better. And I think, you know, in that waiting time, I think they did more things than waiting, right? Because there's also some proportion of Asian ancestry in people living today in that area in La Paz. So those two signals were like the two major kind of isolated pockets of East Asian ancestry, which is again not as you know, frequent as the three major ancestry components in Mexico. But I think focusing the lens of the camera in those particular components, it allows us to map very well where are they located and where are they coming from. So,
thank you. We now have a question sort of open for the whole group. This is from a paleontologist here in San Diego who is wondering. Every now and again, there's evidence for really early human presence in the Americas, long before 20,000 years ago. What do you think the odds are that these are actual well-dated human occupations? Just going to toss that one out.
Just say.
I mean, I have to put another, I'm not following as closely over the past few years or so, but obviously it's, you know, created huge chatter in the fields, both for ancient DNA, genetic population genetics in general, but archaeology. There's been a few different sides as far as memory serves me right that have sort of come up with much older dates for occupation of the Americas. It's hard to say, you know, particularly for the older ones, could they have been, you know, were they necessarily modern here? Well, first of all, were they, you know, accurate and contingent on that, you know, on the dating and also the sort of the identification of the patterns there? Can they be firmly ascribed to modern humans, or could it have been sort of other hominins of which we may not know presently? So yeah, I think the jury's out there. I know there's there's strong thoughts in the field, very polarized thoughts, but I don't know that it's been settled one way or the other, because I feel like both sides are holding on to the results either way. The sort of dates that we do have in terms of the divergence dates of modern native populations from sort of the East ancestors, East Asian ancestors, pardon me, does not go as far back as those ages, for sure. So again, this brings us back to this idea, which, you know, in other parts of Eurasia and the world, we have taken a step back to consider, well, could older dates, particularly in Africa, for example, there have been you know, scenarios proposed of maybe archaic admixture pushing some of the dates back or generating kind of older population structure. Again, we don't know if the presence of or the range of different kinds of hominins across, you know, this part of the world. So I wouldn't hazard a guess because I'm not in archaeology, but I think the fact that the common ancestor that the sort of that we can date back for the modern the ancestors of present indigenous populations in East Asia don't go as far back as those states. So again, it's hard to kind of keep those consistent. I will keep rambling.
Maybe just one aspect that I wanted to add to this question is a very complex question. So we kind of could probably discuss for hours about that. But one of what I found quite interesting, we have now a researcher at the Institute that does primate archaeology. And I didn't know a lot about that, but actually primates produce archaeology as well, and they produce stone tools. And there's actually a population of capuchin monkeys that is found in Brazil that lives in some of the sites where people have claimed that humans were actually there more than 30,000 years ago, because there's a lot of stone tools there. And actually the capuchin monkeys that live there make the same type of stone tools. So stone tools don't always have to be made by humans, right? They can also be made by monkeys. So that, of course, doesn't explain the kind of New Mexico footprints. That doesn't explain like lots of the other findings, the trampled mammoth bones somewhere like in this area here. I think there's all kind of potential other explanations. But certainly it is the case that the Native Americans today go back to the common ancestor about 15 to a maximum 20,000 years ago. So they cannot be, there's really no, from the genetic data we have so far, there's no evidence for an earlier occupation in the Americas prior to about 15,000 years, I would say. No, interesting one.
No, I pretty much agree. I mean, it's true. There's other dating artifacts and things that can date way earlier than that. But I agree that from the genetic evidence, we don't have so far evidence that coincides with what we have from human-derived materials, right?
Okay, I have a bonus question for Dienda, who's not in my session, but I'm gonna give it to you anyway. It's like it's a good question. So much of the early African fossil hominin record is limited to the periphery, so in East Africa, South Africa, North Africa. Were people living in Central and West Africa, and what will it take to find those fossils?
I think like people were definitely living. I think in West Africa, I mean, they are. I think like the environment is definitely a little bit more challenging to just like go through because like it's like the equatorial forest and there's a lot going on, but I think like there's just not enough archaeology in the region for the like exactly for the same reason that it's actually a very challenging environment. But I know, for example, from Gabon in Western Africa, there's like few cave sites or like actually site, but you have like they found like evidence of like human occupation and also like a type of like stone tool industry that had never been like described before for the region and stuff like that. And those are very in places that are also very remote and difficult to access. So I actually think like, there's like one site where they say that they have dates all the way up to like 21,000 years of human occupation in Gabon. So yeah, definitely the human were there, but it's like just difficult to find their trace because I think of the environment. Yeah.
All right, and we have a question for Johannes. The question is, how do we know that only 300 people originally spread across Europe?
So I didn't talk about the analysis we did there, but we did two types of analysis. I think it was Jeno also presented that type of work. One is looking at runs of homozygosity, where you basically look at regions in the genome where the two chromosomes are identical from a common ancestor, just like in the past. So this can be caused by having closely related parents, like consanguinity. But this can also be caused, if they're especially kind of shorter regions, by a small population. So if you have a small population, there's a big chance that your parents have a common ancestor in recent time. So the smaller the population, the more chances you find those short regions of relatives of homozygosity, and the larger the population, you don't find it. So if you have a large population, there's a very small chance that your parents are kind of closer related. And what we have here is basically a lot of those cases where we have this type of short runs of homozygosity, which is one way to actually estimate that. Now, this is a genetic measure of population size. It doesn't necessarily reflect completely the census size. So there's other ways, for example, looking at heterozygosity, looking at the kind of chromosomes and the differences that you see, which I think Diandra has also shown. And heterozygosity, if you do that for humans, for example, as a measure of effective population size, you get for modern humans long-term populations of 10,000. And clearly, we're more than 10,000 people on the planet. So something must be wrong then with this type of estimates. And indeed, those kind of measures don't really work well for kind of shorter time periods, more for long time periods. But actually, runs of homozygosity work pretty well in their maximum effect of 2 off from the census size. So could be like 300 individuals, could be 600, but not so much more. And then the other thing that you can do is look at IBD tracks, so which is kind of a similar kind of thing. It's kind of like tracks that come from a common ancestor between two individuals. As I've shown, people are related, fifth degree, third degree, and so forth. And then again, if you have a small population, there's a higher chance that you actually share a kind of segment with someone in the past. Because there was a common ancestor, so the smaller population, like if you, for example, go to a random village, you pick 10 people from the cemetery, there's a very high chance you find that they are related because it's a small population. If you go to a large cemetery in a large city, that two individuals are actually closely related is pretty unlikely. And this is another way to actually do this population size estimates. And there's a lot of new tools now getting developed, which is actually quite exciting. This is a big question that archaeologists often have, how many people lived at a certain time period. And I do think that over the next couple of years, we will see a whole suite of different types of estimates of population sizes that are actually quite close to the census size. So unlike heterozygosity, which is, again, not the best measure, those are actually quite exciting because they're pretty close to the actual census size of those ancient population, which works well for small population, actually doesn't work for large populations. We can't say if it's a million or a billion. That's kind of a different problem we have.
Well, thank you so much. So that's all the time, unfortunately, we have for Q&A. So please join me in thanking all of the speakers. And next up, we're going to have our closing remarks from Pascal.
Well, I'd like to thank not just the speakers for an excellent collection of fascinating talks, and I would like to thank the audience here and thank the audience online, and convince you that, you know, if you want more Carta, I hope you want more Carta. That was an example of why we need more Carta. Consider supporting us. Hopefully by now you have scanned your QR code, but you have your program. We're easy to find on the web, and you can catch not only the recordings of today's talks, but the over 400 recordings of all the existing Carta talks are on YouTube, on UCTV, or on the Carta website. So with that, I wish you a wonderful rest of the day. And again, thank you to all the speakers. Thank to all of you, and hope to see you again soon.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.